right, I'm going to let the people weigh in on this, the question we'd asked in the previous segment as we head into the 9 o'clock hour. Good to be with you on a Tuesday. Nick Caserio joins us tomorrow at 7:30 on the show. Penderpool, hypothetically, the Astros are 1-1 in a wild card round series. They've used Hunter Brown and Framber Valdez in games 1 and 2. Who starts game 3? Spencer Arrighetti, Christian Javier, Luis Garcia, Jason Alexander. Those are the four choices. I am hitting send. Is there a bias depending on the order you list people in on a
probably
poll? I feel like this is something you would know, or that you.
Yeah, it seems like the kind of thing I used to know.
Okay.
I know there's definitely. All I know is that anytime you ask any kind of a poll question, yeah, all that stuff matters.
Okay.
So I don't know.
Okay.
If there's a way you could randomize it, it might help. I don't know.
Oh, yeah. There's not. So I'm going to hit send. There we go. Okay. The poll that will change the world right there. All right. The Athletic has an article that's up where they've got 31 coaches and executives who voted on various categories and questions. MVP of the league, starting a franchise from scratch. You can choose three quarterbacks. The various best offensive player, best defensive player, and so forth. I'll circle back to those. We hit those pretty heavy yesterday. I thought a couple of the interesting questions, Seth. One plays into the game on Sunday between the Rams and the Texans. The other plays into the Texans' schedule, which I thought was interesting. Before we get into the Rams-Texans angle with this, here was D'Amico Ryans on what it's like game planning against Sean McVay.
Nothing. It's all fresh. It's all new. That's the cool part about game planning and prepping. Like, for me, you have past history, but for me, I don't harp on that too much, and I don't get too bogged down on that. That's really the focus on what our guys do well, allowing them to go play fast. You can get bogged down on all the extra stuff, the window dressing, but you just got to let guys go play fast, especially first game. There are a ton of wrinkles. Their guys haven't played in the preseason at all, so it'll be the first time we see their outfit out, and we'll see, you know, how they're utilizing guys. Where are they going to use Davante Adams? You know, how does Puka? What is his role? So it's a lot of unknown, especially with these guys. So, you know, I don't go in trying to figure it all out. I let our guys, you know, do the talking. I let our guys just play ball, play fast, play relentless, and let's see, you know, who comes out on top.
Do we have clarity on whether D'Amico's calling plays or calling the defenses?
Defense?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
I don't either,
I think that Matt Burke is – I don't know.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I'm not sure either.
There never has really been clarity about it. The problem is that they all give the same answer because there's always – it's always a committee affair.
Sure.
You know, there's different coaches are responsible for different areas of the field in different situations.
Yeah.
So the question I think is more about, like, okay, how involved is D'Amico going to be on the defensive side of the ball in general?
Yeah. Okay, so
As far as what he was talking about there, the question was asked, like, how much does your previous experience with Sean McVay factor in to how you game plan against them? And that's why he said nothing or it doesn't at all, whatever he started off that with. I think this is where the analytics does help some, and coaches that know how to use them, is that D'Amico knows that he might have some things in his brain that he thinks he knows about Sean McVay. But he also knows, because he understands the value of analytics, that, like, okay, those are probably my blind spots. And if I have some kind of assumption about the way McVay's going to call a game, that I it's better for me to lean on what the analytics folks say his tendencies have been in the last couple of years than anything from back when I faced him.
Mm-hmm.
But then also understanding that in week one, you throw a lot of that out the window, because Sean McVay has been looking, self-scouting his own tendencies in the offseason and thinking, you know, so if you start overthinking or predicting how a coach is going to act in game one of the season, especially, you're setting yourself up for an ambush.
I just thought it was interesting on this this exercise that we touched on here that the Athletic did, where they pulled 31 coaches and executives on various categories. Two of the categories that they asked about were offensive play call. Who's the best offensive play caller? You can name three. And who's the best defensive play caller? You can also name three. In this exercise, Sean McVay was the winner of all the offensive play callers. He was named on 25 of the 31 ballots. D'Amico Ryans got one vote, period, mm-hmm. one vote So am I to believe that we've got a mismatch here, Seth, in terms of the play callers?
No. I think because if you look at that list, the top five defensive play callers all run a 3-4 defense.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a little bit of a bias there because there's more complexity with a 3-4 defense than there is with a 4-3 or a 4-2. And I think it's more of a – I think if you're going to start getting offended, you got to go down to – was it Green Bay's defensive coordinator? I think it was the top vote-getter of a 4-3 defense.
Good Halfley. Oh, Halfley, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So that's where you start the competition between 4-3s versus 3-4s.
Yep.
Because the top ones were, if I remember correctly, it was Vic Fangio – Mike McDonald was one of them.
Brian was, I got it right here. It's Fangio was the winner. He was named on 20 of the 31. Then Brian Flores,
yeah.
16.
3-4 defense.
Steve Spagnuolo, uh-huh. 15. Mike McDonald was fourth. He got 6 votes. And then Vance Joseph was fifth. He got 5 votes. And then Jeff Halfley of Green Bay is 6th on here.
No, I think D'Amico would tell you he doesn't do things. He never wants to be as complex as a guy like Fangio. He just wants his guys to be able to play really, really fast.
Yep.
So there's and then also, I wonder, I was going to say, does him being a head coach or anything affect any of it? I don't think it does. I think it's just a matter of just his chosen methodology. It's not as much about the whiteboard stuff as it is the actual execution on the field.
Yeah, the head coach is Mike McDonald's a head coach. He finished 4th. Todd Bowles was 7th on here, head coach. You know, Vrabel found a couple votes on here. So, yeah. The other thing I thought was interesting is that the Athletic asked these 31 head coach or 31 coaches and executives, name 3 teams that will exceed expectations this season. Name 3 teams. The Texans only wound up getting 1 vote in that exercise. That's neither here nor there. They also asked 3 teams that'll fall short of expectations. There were only 23 responses on that one. There were only 25 on the first one.
They did this weird. It was like because they were supposed to pick 3, but then the votes don't. I don't get how they did this poll.
Well, so they let some of the coaches and executives. They didn't have to answer every question, and I'm going, why would you not answer that if you're a coach or an executive? Who cares?
Yeah.
It's anonymous, you know. But whatever.
So, what did the Texans? How many votes did they get for not meeting expectations?
For falling short, they got 3.
Oh,
they got 3 along with the Cowboys and the Falcons. Those are other teams. Now, what's interesting, a couple things interesting. I'll get to the Texans one in a second. The Lions were named on 16 of the 23 ballots for falling short of expectations.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing that has to do predominantly with them losing both of their coordinators this offseason.
Yeah, you lose both coordinators and both highly regarded guys. Aaron Glenn goes off to the Jets. Ben Johnson goes off to the Bears to be a head coach. And Campbell's not a coordinator on either side of the ball or special teams. So this is the real test for if you're somebody that always thinks you should hire an offensive coordinator as your head coach or what have you. Like this is twofold. Like this would be at the very least hire a guy that's got expertise on one side of the ball or the other. I mean, I guess you would call him an offensive minded coach because he was a tight end and a tight ends coach, but he's not. He's known as more just of a complete and total head coach than a coordinator.
Yeah, he's going to fully delegate to both of these guys. It's almost like he's hiring 2 semi head coaches to work for him. You know,
and then they in the offense. It's just the preseason, but for whatever it's worth, the offense did not look good in the preseason. They didn't. If you're a Lions fan and you're like, okay, this is changing, we're losing Ben Johnson, but let's just see some signs of life in the preseason, and they really didn't see that.
If you're botching an offense that has that offensive line, those 2 running backs, that tight end, they got good receivers. You know, that's if you're.
They got Jared Goff. But I don't know. Is Jared Goff a Ben Johnson creation? Or
that's a fair question.
What is Jared Goff at this point?
Fair question. Here's the Texans' angle to this exceeding expectations, falling short of expectations thing. And I'm curious what you think about this, Seth. I think the Texans' schedule, in terms of the opponents, is more difficult than last year. Slightly, maybe. You know, the NFC North was really tough to cross over with, granted, last year. But I think they cross over with both Western divisions, the AFC West and the NFC West, and I don't think there's any patsies in either of those divisions. But I like the way the schedule lays out, that they're not playing 3 games in 11 days multiple times, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The exceeding expectations, where they ask guys to pick three teams who will exceed expectations. Four of the top five in this poll are on the Texans' schedule. The Cardinals, the Raiders, the Buccaneers, and the Seahawks are all on the Texans' schedule, and they were four of the top five vote-getters in teams expected to exceed expectations by this group of NFL people.
I think the Bucs are really interesting to me, and I'm not taking them lightly at all in the Texans' second game of the season. And yet, they've got a offensive coordinator that nobody's ever heard of, and he's replacing Liam Cohen, who took that offense from one of the worst in the league in a lot of respects to one of the best, and got the absolute most out of Baker Mayfield. And you know, you draft Ibuka. You still got Mike Evans. You've got Chris Godwin, however he is coming back from injury. But maybe it's just because of the Bucs that I have a hard time seeing it. And it's weird saying, I say just the Bucs because like obviously they've won a couple Super Bowls more than the Texans.
Well, they've made the playoffs with this group a couple of times.
Right, right. But I think that Liam Cohen was a big part of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, it's just hard for me to envision. Their offensive line played really well, but again, I don't know how much of that was Liam Cohen versus just that it's a genuinely good offensive line.
Seahawks are a Monday night game that starts really late, 9 o'clock local time. And then the Cardinals and the Raiders are part of the Texans' schedule down the stretch. They play both those teams at home in December. Do any of those teams?
Kyler Murray kind of just started to look like the best version of himself as the season went on last year.
Yeah, they were 8-9 last year. They weren't a bad football team.
Right, no, they weren't a bad football team at all. I think the Marvin Harrison Jr. supposedly put on like 10 pounds of muscle.
I have him in two of my fantasy leagues. I hope he put on.
Oh, do you?
Yeah. I have him and Kyler in a couple of leagues, a double dip.
The ones that concern me the most are the good, solid teams that you face on the road when it comes to the Seahawks and the Broncos especially, just because those are hard places
Broncos
to play.
Broncos are here. Broncos.
Oh, the Broncos are in Houston. That's
Broncos,
right. Never
Broncos
mind.
Are here,
I'm less worried about the Broncos on the road than now, Sean.
Yeah.
The Seahawks, most notably, obviously the Ravens and the Chiefs, that's a given.
Yeah.
I would not sleep on the Seahawks and the difficulty of playing them, especially a defense, like a good defense Seahawks in Seattle. Like there's a
Monday
reason
night?
That they got to steal that slogan from Texas A&M.
Yes.
That 12th man is the real deal out there. It's a rough place to play for a quarterback.
Yeah, and that'll be a late game on Monday night. That'll be a tough one for sure. Now the flip side to this, so while the Texans have four of their opponents who these group of NFL people have said they expect to exceed expectations, when you're picking teams falling short of expectations, only two of the top 10 on their are on the Texans' schedule. The Broncos were named on five ballots of teams expected to fall short. The Niners were named on four. They actually play them in back-to-back weeks. In week 8 and week 9, they play the Niners and the Broncos. So of all these teams, Seth, that coaches and execs around the league expect maybe to not be as good as we all think they're going to be, the Texans play hardly any of those teams. You know, they're playing way more teams that this group of voters see as having upside as opposed to having downside. So maybe the schedule's a little harder than I'm thinking right now.
And I've still got this pipe dream of this being the year that it all falls apart for the Chiefs somehow. That
you're not alone,
I think their defense is still going to be really good, but I don't think they've really fixed these pass protection issues. And look, Travis Kelce hasn't been the same guy for a couple years now, but he had been able to pour it on in the playoffs a couple years ago. Last year, he poured it on versus the Texans, but that was really the only time. I hope they can be a nice, respectable team that goes 7-10 based on having a really, really good defense. But that's pretty much the sum total of it.
Yeah.
And then we'll never have to hear about them again.
I'm sure. That would be great. I would love it if that Chiefs team you're describing showed up in week 13 or whatever it is when the Texans play them. I think they play Sunday night in Kansas City. I think it's a Sunday night game. They play the Chiefs this year in December. That would be good if the Chiefs were a little less formidable than they've been in past years. All right, Payne and Pendergast with you. We'll hit some more Texans as we go. Good weekend if you're a hater in the college football world. What is our expectation? What's the shelf life of Bill Belichick that we're feeling after 1 week last night against TCU? We'll touch on some of what we saw last night. We'll do that coming up next.
It's a big drive for the North Carolina defense. That was the Capital One rewarding performance, and this is a rewarding run as Gavorian Barnes is out the gate, inside the 30, to the 10. Touchdown TCU, 75 yards and no flags.
That was literally Kirk Herbstreit as TCU is coming to the line of scrimmage for the first play from scrimmage of the second half. And he's like, and it's 20-7 at the time. You know, it's still a game. It's still a two-score game. And Herbstreit's like, it's a big drive for the North Carolina defense here. You know, you got to get off the field. And literally the first play, they hand it to the guy. He goes off tackle to the house. Doesn't even have to juke anybody. Just like it was a 75-yard sprint
to the house. It was a big drive for the UNC defense there.
Yeah.
That was the game. That was something big happened. Yeah.
He was right.
That was it. Yep.
He was right. So that's
Were there any positives to take from UNC's performance?
Well, their first drive was really nice. They like methodically went down the field 83 yards.
Yeah.
You know, that first drive. Look, we rooted for a team here in Houston, Seth, that for 2 years couldn't score anything on the opening drive with Bill O'Brien as the head coach. And Belichick did you see his play caller is Freddie Kitchens, the old Cleveland Browns coach.
Yeah,
they were able to draw up a nice drive to get 7. They were just not able to draw up anything else good. So I don't think so. If anything, they've probably got a quarterback controversy now. Brad Johnson's kid is the backup quarterback. He used to play at A&M, and he's the backup at UNC. And he actually came in and did some decent things in the second half. But I watched the whole game. There was not a lot of good for North Carolina in this game. There was a pick six. There were deep shots. Against them, just not good, man.
Who would you be more discouraged by if you're equally a fan as so many people are of Arch Manning and Bill Belichick? Which of those two do you still feel relatively optimistic about for this season?
Honestly, kind of both of them. If I had to pick one, I would say Arch Manning. Because I think the level of competition, that might be the hardest team. I know they're in the SEC.
Yeah.
That might be the hardest game environment he's in all year long.
Well, and especially facing that defense with no film on it beforehand, especially, I can't go where Orlovsky is going and acting like missing simple throws is excusable because it's hard, because that defense was tough.
Yeah.
Like, no, at some point, you just got to stand up and not be a horrible quarterback. But it is understandable, and it is his first start. And everything, the infrastructure he has around him, regardless of however you feel about Sarkisian, it's much better than whatever Belichick's working with at UNC.
Well,
is that the actual talent that he has to work with?
There's a possibility with Belichick that does not exist with Arch Manning. And the possibility with Belichick is that he might either be checked out or will check out at some point and just collect his money and then just, you know, leave after a year, or that, you know, that he's lost his touch or whatever. Like Arch Manning, I'm guessing, is going to do everything he possibly can to live up to the expectations that everybody has for him out there.
Yeah, I guess I'd be really surprised if Belichick checked out emotionally or anything in the middle of the
season. I would
too.
No, but I'm saying there's a 0% chance I feel that happens with Arch Manning. Belichick's 73 years old. He might look around and go, okay, this ain't for me. This is a young man's game.
Yeah, but I guess that would be at the end of the season. You think he might do it during the season?
I don't know if he'd do it during the season. I'm just saying, you're asking me who I feel better about moving forward
for this year.
Between those two. For this year?
Yeah, I meant for this season.
I think he could do it without announcing it. Like, I think they could be 2-7 in week 9 or 10, and he's not going to be the best version of himself the rest of the year. He's like, I got a 24-year-old rocket over here, man. I got $10 million bucks.
I guess I don't know. I have a hard time. I think people continually kind of try to treat Belichick like he's a normal person or something, and where he clearly isn't. I don't think he has that in him. Even if he might physiologically get more tired or something because he can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
But I would have a hard time just seeing him just packing in emotionally.
I would too. I'm not saying it's a favorite. I'm saying there's zero chance that happens with Arch Manning, and I'm saying there's a 2% chance that happens with Belichick.
Arch Manning could get benched.
Could get benched. Yeah, he could. Yeah. He could get benched. I doubt he will, but he could get benched. Yeah. So I would say, how about you? Who do you feel better about?
I feel better about Arch Manning.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. Look, it's not like I've been following UNC football closely for the last 4 years, and Kano can extol exactly why this is going to be the year that they break through or bust through. But it's just he's Belichick started off in the hole just by coaching at UNC.
Yeah.
And it's not the same as, you know, Harbaugh went to Stanford. Stanford gets a different level of recruits than UNC does already. So it was impressive what Harbaugh was able to do at Stanford, but he was doing it with guys like Andrew Luck and what have you.
Yeah.
And Belichick just doesn't have that. I mean, and he's responsible for recruiting and everything. It's hard to envision a huge turnaround.
That conference, too. Like, if Florida State has actually turned it around like they did against Alabama, you got to go through them. Clemson looks – I know they lost to LSU, but they look more like the old Clemson than they have the last couple of years. So the conference gets a little harder maybe. We'll see. So this was a big topic in the game last night, Seth. Now, this was when the score was 41-14. So very few of us were still up watching this game. I'll admit that. But this was making the rounds on social media. Kirk Herbstreit got caught on a hot mic coming back from the break saying something that got people intrigued here. Again, the score is 41-14 at this point. Here is the broadcast coming back from break.
You're bad. Oh.
Fourth quarter starting here in Chapel Hill.
Okay. So it was construed as him saying, they're bad.
It sounded to me like he was saying you're bad, like somebody just made a joke about something.
And that's what they're saying happened. That's what Herbstreit is saying happened. That's what the producer, their producer or their spotter or somebody who's up in the booth with them made some sort of joke. It's not been made clear what joke was made, but Herbstreit, play it one more time, Ben.
You're bad.
That sounds to me.
See, now people wanted to hear they're bad.
Yeah. Oh, and they heard they're bad?
Some people did. Yeah, some people did. You know, it's like that blue dress or gray dress thing going on.
No, that sounds to me like somebody just said something about what they would do to one of the women in the crowd. that's where you're like,
you're bad.
Yeah, come on. I'm wearing a suit here, man. I'm on a mic. We're back. Yeah.
But, like, I'm looking at the tweet that I pulled this from, posted 11 hours ago. So about the time that this was happening, Barstool Sports, quote, they're bad. Kirk Herbstreit caught on hot mic.
Really?
Yes.
And, like, he clearly says you're, right? Can you play that again?
You're bad.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah. Okay, but I can see why if you heard they're bad first, I can totally see that. Okay, one more time, Ben.
One more time, Ben.
You're bad.
Oh. Yeah.
What is it? What is that thing, the visual thing? It's a blue dress and the gold dress thing going on, right?
It's like the old lady and the young, you know, when there's a silhouette, you see one side and that's what you see.
Yeah,
okay. All right, now I can hear both. Now that I've heard they're bad. Okay, one more time, Ben.
You're bad.
Well, Sean was laughing. One more time.
You're bad.
All right, that does sound more like they're bad.
Really?
Yeah, I think it does.
Okay. Ben,
It's not clear enough, though, for me to say definitively one way or the other.
Right. Ben?
You're bad.
Oh, the dress is gold, man. It's a gold dress.
You're bad. They're bad. Oh.
That got a lot of.
I feel like the tone of voice is still like you're bad. Like you made a dirty joke.
I believe Kirk Herbstreit when he says that. You know,
that's either you made a really dirty joke or you said something like really clever but petty about something else.
Yeah.
That's what I'm usually saying during the petty cast when I'm kind of shocked by how petty you're being. I'm like you're bad.
Yeah. You're bad.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's why it sounded so familiar. After further review, the play is confirmed. He said, "You're." That's a text.
Okay. I wonder if people are split on this.
Yeah. So far, two votes on the text page with "You're okay. bad." I haven't gotten any there yet.
I think I'm falling down towards "You're bad," but I can totally see why people could have heard that as "They're bad."
Yeah. The lesson in all this is be careful. The mics are hot. You never know.
Was there anybody? So during the game, other than that first drive, was there any point where you thought, "Oh, okay, well, you know what? With a few different bounces of the ball or something."
No,
they're bad.
Nope.
You agree with Herbstreit?
I agree with Herbstreit. I agree with the blue dress Herbstreit. Yes, they're bad. No, I had TCU. The spread was 3.5. I bought it down to 3 just in case it was a close game at the end. I even after the first drive. once TCU got, that was the first drive of the game. Once TCU got the ball and I watched them kind of operate, I don't even know if they scored on their first drive, TCU. I was not nervous at all. You could see what was happening in the trenches in that game, Seth. Mm-hmm. And you could see defensively, like, okay, this, they're not ready. This is not a Belichick. Yeah. This is not a Belichick defense. I was never concerned. Maybe after the first drive, because we had yet to see TCU get on the field. Mm-hmm. UNC just marches down and scores. I'm like, oh, okay. This is the kind of weekend I've been having. But then once I saw TCU get the ball, I'm like, nah, they'll be fine. They'll cover the three. I'm not worried.
Speaking of Herbstreit, Lee Corso's final appearance on College Game Day drew 3.5 million viewers, which was the most watched game day ever.
Yeah.
The final 15 minutes of the show pulled in 5.1 million viewers.
Yeah.
What's did you watch the last 15 minutes?
I was at Boomer Jacks in Katy. I did. I was at a bar, so I was kind of watching it bar style. But yeah.
Did he get emotional?
A lot of people did. Yeah.
Did Herbstreit cry?
I don't remember. Probably, okay. If I had to guess, he's a crier. He likes, you know, it's no.
I haven't watched
any
of Corso's final appearance, mostly because I try to remain as dead inside as possible. So if I know something's emotional or something, I just like, I'm just not gonna touch that.
Again,
today.
I was in a bar and it was loud, and I'm just looking up at it. I'm not like, yeah. I wasn't in my chair like dialed into it, so I'm probably not a great person to ask. To me, again, the most remarkable thing is that. It was on. They carried it on both of the pregame shows, the Fox pregame show and the ESPN pregame show.
Which I feel like ESPN giving them permission to do that. I don't think they needed to do that. They should have said, no, this is our property. That 5.1 million viewers could have been like 6.1 million.
I was about to say, I'm like, they drew 5.1 million.
Yeah. I mean, what, are we going to stop being petty as television executives or something? No. You keep your dirty grubs off of our intellectual property. You're not allowed to simulcast the Lee Corso, the final showing of Lee Corso.
They should have done a trade. They should have said, we'll let you simulcast all the Dave Portnoy bits where he's yelling at Ohio State fans.
Yeah.
If you let us simulcast Lee Corso's last segment.
Yeah.
That's what they should have done. Should have been a transaction.
Suits. They're such idiots.
Sorry, but I'm glad Corso is not on anymore. He's done with game day, right? He's been needing to retire for a long time. It's been painful. Again, sorry. Well, you don't need to apologize to us. He hasn't had his fastball in a long, long time, but I think they've done a decent job of carrying him. I think we know what Lee Corso is and has been. He's there to entertain. He says it himself. It's about entertainment, baby, and he's there to do his mascot head thing and do the not so fast, my friend, and point a pencil at Pat McAfee.
Look, knowing full well that I one day will succumb to this very logic that I'm about to present, or this argument I'm about to present, is that once you start losing your fastball as a broadcaster, boot him the hell off my television. That's how I feel about it. That's
really?
How sentimental I am. Put him out on the ice floe. Yeah, I don't get it. I don't get it. I think it's people writing angry letters to the editor of like, you better not fire this old guy or something. Like, no, someday all the guys who are my age will be old men that'll be upset that I got fired or something.
Yeah.
And I'll tell them. We'll all go meet at a McDonald's and I'll do 15 minutes of sport talk in the morning. They're like, no, that was the right decision.
I was old
and ineffective and the youngs didn't like me.
You're gonna wind up, that was the right thing to do. Throw your fastball and it's going to be 38 miles an hour. And like, see?
I'm gonna tear my UCL while I do it.
That's right. All right, Payne and Pendergast with you here on a Tuesday. D'Amico Ryan's challenge to his team in 2025. He talked about that yesterday. We'll hear from the Texans head coach. We'll find out what the guys got going on In the Loop, question of the day, all that good stuff as well. All right, Payne and Pendergast with you. David Mulugeta on First Take right now. I'm going to have to go back and listen to that interview with Stephen A. Smith. David Mulugeta, the arch nemesis of Jerry Jones in the Micah Parsons deal. It's just dawned on me, Seth, because they were showing as an inset on the screen with Stephen A. and Mulugeta, they were showing a lot of Packers practice stuff going on because that's who Micah is on right now. But so is Jordan Love, who's a Mulugeta guy. Mulugeta has made good money from doing contracts with the Green Bay Packers the last couple years.
Yeah.
Jordan Love might end up 55 mil and Micah 47 mil a year.
He's made good money doing contracts with the Texans, too, in the last few years.
Yep.
Because he first got the initial contract for Deshaun Watson.
Yep.
And then worked alongside the Texans in getting him a mega contract with the Cleveland Browns.
Yes, we credit the Texans for that Cleveland Browns contract.
Yes, yes. But they don't have to pay any of the penalties
right.
for it. But then also Derek Stingley. So they worked with Derek Stingley. Got that deal done relatively early in the process. Compared to the people that are just now announcing deals and what have you. So I don't worry at all about Mulligetta being an issue with C.J. Stroud. The biggest thing, honestly, when you look at quarterbacks who end up having really team-friendly deals for multiple years, the biggest factor is that the quarterback trusts the organization.
Yeah.
And look, Tom Brady and Pat Mahomes – are two of those guys. Like, those are the most notable guys. Tom Brady played at a discount forever. Pat Mahomes' deal has become a discount, and he hasn't agitated for a new contract or anything, even as he becomes, I don't know if he's even in the top 10 for quarterbacks anymore.
I was looking at this yesterday. Yeah, right. He's like AA for average annual value. He's in the teens now. He's like 14th or something like that.
And those are two quarterbacks that really trusted their organization, which the other big factor in the key, Sean, win a Super Bowl.
You got to win.
Point.
Then
they feel way better about the organization. Then the quarterback feels more like, yeah, I need to keep this going. I need to sacrifice a little financially because we got a good thing going here. It's hard. It's hard. I understand why quarterbacks would be hesitant to just go all in on that if you're playing for a team like the Browns or something. I feel like right now, CJ Stroud and the Texans are in a really good place about how they feel good about each other.
Well,
winning a Super Bowl would be nice to help. Well, winning a Super Bowl would actually, even though it would make C.J. Stroud more valuable as a quarterback, it would also make him more likely to take a really team-friendly deal. Into the future.
It's a chicken and egg thing because both the guys you named, I mean, those are the two guys that you bring up in this argument. They're valid to bring up, but Tom Brady had won 3 Super Bowls before there was probably any discussion of a new contract for him. Mm-hmm. Like he was, and Patrick Mahomes signed his new deal in 2020 after they'd won a Super Bowl in 2019 and then lost to the Buccaneers. No, it was before they lost to the Buccaneers. Yeah. So they had won the Super Bowl the year before.
Yeah.
What comes first, the trust or the Super Bowl? For Brady and Mahomes, easy to trust because they'd won Super Bowls before the contract was even an issue.
Right.
Yeah.
And they see the value of like, okay, you know, even on the financial side, all right, my earnings off the field and everything are going to be a lot greater if I'm in a situation that's super competitive all the time. And now in Mahomes, I think some people listening might be like, wait a second, didn't Mahomes sign a mega contract? He signed a contract that looked really good on the headlines, but it was a very team-friendly deal.
Yeah.
It was a 10-year deal. And the Chiefs held all the cards.
Yeah.
And then the most important thing is he hasn't agitated to restructure it. So over time, as contracts tend to do, and with cap inflation, he's not one of the highest paid quarterbacks anymore. And like a lot of other quarterbacks, or maybe Pat Mahomes himself, if he was in a different situation and he didn't feel really good about his coach and the organization, he wouldn't be doing it. But So that's all simple, Sean. All you got to do is win a Super Bowl.
That's it.
You
win a Super Bowl, and then I'm sure CJ is just taking a pay cut to make sure we can keep the party going.
It's not
going to
be a pay cut. It's a matter of like him signing the deal and then being cool with it for a few years.
Yeah.
You know, before people start letting their feelings get involved.
Hey, by the way, Deshaun Watson, no longer a Houston resident, it appears. His $1.3 million Houston mansion sold. This is August 29th is the article that I'm looking at here.
Yeah, I've got an issue with the Chronicle calling that a mansion. It's a big house.
It's a big house, yeah.
We live in Houston. We've seen mansions. Usually 25% of them are occupied by mega church pastors. The other 75% oil and gas. But they're not, this is a McMansion. If you could call it a McMansion, it's a big house.
They have and it's in a neighborhood that's got an overhead shot. You know, it's in a nice neighborhood. I'm sure a gated community. It's 5,264 square feet. He bought it in March of 2018. So as he was coming back from his torn ACL, he said, you know what? I need to be a homeowner, and I'm going to go live in this neighborhood here. And I forget the name of the street he lives on, but I believe the word legendary is in it.
It was Legends Lane or something.
Legends,
I remember
from
one of the court processing things. Yeah.
The home is reported to be worth $1.3 million. So this is clearly out in the burbs somewhere. if it's worth one point, if
to
it's
have 50, a big house like that,
dude.
With,
I mean,
$1.3 million.
Yeah, this thing was, you know, near River Oaks Boulevard. This thing's, you know, triple that at least.
How big is a mansion these days? I feel like 5,000. I mean, 5,000 square feet is it's a big house. Don't get me wrong, but it's not a mansion.
No. Yeah, I don't.
It's a nice house. I got kind of sad looking at it, thinking about like, oh, that. They had family dinners there and everything, used to be a before things. You know, I don't know.
Yeah, they a lot of pictures.
Made some bad decisions.
A lot
man.
Of pictures. Yeah, they probably moved that table right there to bring the massage table in, like right there.
The pool is pretty badass.
Pool's nice, man, and he's got an outdoor kitchen next to it. It is. It's a pretty house, but it's off the market. If you're thinking of buying it, sorry, it's just not available anymore.
Okay, according to AI. A mansion is at least 5,000 square feet or more, with many professionals defining it as 8,000 plus square feet.
Okay, not a mansion.
I get. You know why I'm screwed up on this a little bit? Because I remember just I used to when I lived in Jacksonville, I had friends who were in Orlando, and we would go out on. I had my friend had a little ski boat, and we'd go out on the lakes there, like Shaq and a few other in that development where Tiger Woods and everybody.
Lou Holtz lives there.
Those are mansions.
Yeah.
Like Shaq had a full basketball court inside and outside, I think.
Yeah.
And I want to say it was like 50,000 square feet or something absurd.
That's
it was like that. Like that's what I think of as mansion. And maybe it's because of my time in Florida where there's a lot of big, gaudy mansions. People build them as big as possible because they can't take it from you in a bankruptcy there. And the no state income taxes and all that.
Yeah, that's the one. That's the development where Tiger, the gated
Isleworth,
community.
Right?
Isleworth, that's what it is.
Yeah.
Where the one, what's the, Elon took the nine iron to the back window of Tiger's car.
Shaq and possibly his grill. Yeah. Shaq's massive former Florida mansion was reportedly 76,000 square feet.
Okay, yeah. I mean, that's a mansion.
Oh my God.
That's a mansion. That's just, it feels like a lot to maintain, man. I don't even care if you're paying people to maintain it. That feels like a job managing your house.
Yeah, I would never want a household staff.
No.
That would be awful.
No.
I want to walk around in my natural state.
Hell yeah.
And, you know, we don't need to get HR involved in me just trying to grab some milk out of the fridge.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Here's D'Amico Ryans yesterday. Last question of his press conference. What's the challenge to your team in 2025?
The challenge for us is to be as best as you can possibly be. It's each individual. Like, how are you showing up on game day? Are you locked in on your assignments? Are you dominating your one-on-one? Are you dominating that daily process outside of the building when we're not doing ball? Are you taking care of all the little things the right way? And we'll see how that collectively comes together on game day. But I just challenge everybody to continue to grow, continue to get better, and continue to, you know, push yourself, strain mentally and physically to be your best. I feel like this is such a privilege, it's such a blessing to get the opportunity to play in the NFL. It's a dream for so many guys. So when you are here, you're in the building, you're on a team, how are you taking advantage of that dream? I think about all the guys who I played with in middle school, high school, who didn't get the opportunity to be where we are. So how would those guys, how would they respond if they were in your shoes? They would die for this opportunity to play in the NFL, right? So we're here. How do we take advantage of it? How do we maximize it? And how do we just represent for the city of Houston? Right, to make our fans proud of what we're doing.
Maximize your minutes, man. That's the message right there.
Yeah, that I think they've done a really good job of drafting guys the last few years that are kind of just made from the same cloth as D'Amico and just really genuinely hard workers. They're kind of they genuinely care about football more than the lifestyle. Yeah, a lot of times you get rookies where you're like, oh, this guy is all about just wanting to the lifestyle versus being all about football. I think he really has a good eye for figuring out which guys genuinely care about football.
Agreed. Game this Sunday, 3:25 kick, 12:25 Texans countdown. That's me and you, Seth. That'll be fun. And then Clint Sterner and I will take you into the evening hours on the postgame show. Man, I can't wait.
The line moved, huh?
It
had been stuck at 2.5 forever. The Texans were 2.5-point underdogs. And I'm guessing that with every day there being a positive report about Matt Stafford feeling good, that now the Texans are 3.5-point underdogs.
And as you pointed out,
disrespect.
Well, as you mentioned, too, when you and I were talking about that off the air, to go through the number three is in such a short period of time is a big deal. Like, three is a football number that is a number that's hard to move off of. It's hard, you know, 2.5 to 3 is, oh, okay, well, that's a field goal. When you get it over a field goal, that's a big deal in the gambling world. So Stafford getting the, at least, you know, getting the verbal clean bill of health from Sean McVay. None of us know, other than Matthew Stafford, how that back is truly feeling. I know how it's going to feel. If their tackles miss any blocks on Danielle Hunter or Will Anderson, it's not going to feel good at all.
Yeah.
But 3.5. I like the Texans plus 3.5, man. I like them okay at 2.5. I really like that half a point over the field goal right there.
Yeah. I mean, how easy is it to re-herniate a disc as a quarterback in the NFL?
That's a good question.
It feels like it would be easy.
Yeah.
It feels like it'd be something you could do without even trying all that hard.
It definitely feels like something Will Anderson or Danielle Hunter could do for Matthew Stafford,
yeah,
for sure.
I think with Stafford, I told you earlier, I kind of look at him in a weird way the same way I do Anthony Richardson, even though Stafford's a much better quarterback. But on any given Sunday, as long as his back feels good, then I'm scared of Matthew Stafford. But the problem is that at any given time, anybody with a back issue knows, like, oh, nope, took a step to go to the bathroom, and that's it. That's when my back gave out.
Yeah,
it's a lot harder to play football than just to do all the other things that happen when people's backs go out.
Yes,
like when they're just lying on the couch,
right,
and their back goes out because they've got back issues.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, we need this to happen. Last thing before we get to the fellas on In the Loop, JT here in Baytown. Greg Olson just aired an awesome interview with CJ Stroud on YouTube. You guys should check it out. Love yourself, guys. I think is he said, he finishes the text with,
I love myself.
I do love myself a lot. Yeah. I wonder if he said love the show, guys, and it was just voice to text. Might have said love yourself.
I think
guys.
It might have been a love you, and then, you know, the
maybe it added self.
Yeah.
Love you guys. Maybe.
Love yourself. It feels like almost kind of like the be someone message or something.
A little bit. Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah, we should put that on a bridge somewhere.
Yeah.
Borderline self helpy. I like
someone
it.
Someone tells me love yourself, guys. I'm like, no problem there. what's up, boys?
Reherniating a disc is not necessarily difficult, according to AI, but depends on risk factors such as obesity, smoking, and poor posture.
Oh, then
well,
Stafford.
He does at least two of those.
Yeah, for sure. Stafford.
He's slouched over smoking a lung dart at any given
that
time.
Face, yeah. That face. That face. Just saying. Yeah.
Did you say smoking? Was that one
yes.
of them?
Obesity, smoking, and poor posture. And female gender is more likely.
To reherniate a disc.
Females are more likely to reherniate.
Oh, okay.
A disc.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's something we've got over them. All right. We're less likely to reherniate a disc.
Which is not
finally,
what I
how do you like them apples, yes. huh?
Is that the genetic side of it? Because I feel like if all things considered, because dudes do stupid things, we are actually more likely to reherniate a disc.
Oh, guys,
a disc
clearly
if we're
have
talking
a,
about that portion.
We're 100 times
we're
more
likely
herniated
to herniate
disc.
A disc,
yes,
but they're more likely to reherniate a disc.
Ah,
I bet a woman, I bet women on average are going to be like, they're doing things like carrying a baby. So if they have a back issue, you're doing something that's kind of like torqued off to one side or like, I don't know. Yeah. What do women do that we don't, that's going to be more likely to I don't know, something with their eyebrows or something.
Maybe,
It's all in the hips.
So
attracting bears to camping sites. Yes. I don't know.
Yeah. Crosstalk.
I don't know how they operate.
That is right the time to drop the
crosstalk. Brought to you by T&M Auto Leasing. So what's the question of the day?
The question of the day. You happened to catch the old Bill Belichick escapade yesterday.
I watched it from beginning to end.
I did too.
I sat around waiting for him to
watching
score 50.
Like a mofo.
I was so mad when they started taking knees. With a minute to go in the game and the goal to go. I'm like, no, this guy's made life miserable for so many people for so many years.
On to Charlotte.
Punch it in.
On to Charlotte.
On to Charlotte.
And you were probably like me after the first drive. I was like, damn it, they're going to be good.
I was. Well, Seth asked me the question, because I had money on the game.
Yeah.
And I had it -3. And Seth asked me, was there any point in that game where you were nervous that, oh, crap, North Carolina's going to be good? And after the first drive, I'm like, okay, that was a really good-looking drive.
Yeah.
I got to see what TCU looks like when they get the ball. And TCU
they
got the ball.
Three and out. Oh, no, they got one first down.
They got one. Yeah, they got the. But I could tell, like, I'm just watching and I'm going, I think they're going to be fine. once they scored TCU, then I was like, okay, well, we're good.
Yeah. Wait, the first TCU offensive drive, you were like they were going to be fine? I thought Steve Belichick had them linebackers triggering really well and, you know, flying.
Maybe
to the football.
It was the second drive then. It was still early.
My thing was, I was just like, damn it.
Yeah.
Why do they have to be good?
Yeah.
But then they're not.
Yeah.
They're not.
Sometimes.
So, question of the day.
Question of the day.
What is an event or an event in your life
that
did not live up to the hype?
Okay. Well, that kind of lived up to the hype for me last night because TCU minus three. Yeah. But I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
I have one. Remember when they had the second Woodstock back in the early
90s? Woodstock 99 was a bleep show.
Yeah. Oh,
was it?
Yeah. No, this, well, I went, okay.
There was Woodstock 99.
Well, the one I'm thinking of was in like 93 in upstate New York. That was when the first time that I'd ever seen mosh pits.
Mm-hmm.
They had a Woodstock up in upstate New York. This is how I knew it was the early 90s. I was living in Connecticut.
Yeah.
So I drove up there to go to it. And I got up there, and I stayed up there for a few songs, and I'm like, this is a bleep show, and I turned around and drove home.
Yeah,
It was a bleep show. I was so excited for it, because, you know, Woodstock is, you know, my parents were at that Woodstock age when the first, they didn't go, but you heard all these legends about it and things like that. I'm like, oh, I'm going to go to the next Woodstock, and I did.
I think there was like a makeshift one that you're talking about, kind of a quickie.
Seth looks like he's looking it up.
Yeah.
There was one, the original in 1969, and then the one that '94 was like the 25th anniversary.
That
was bad, and they had all kinds of issues with water, if I recall.
Yes.
But 99 was the one that was just a complete and total disaster.
Okay, that's not the one.
There were all kinds of. There was like everything that Woodstock wasn't supposed to be.
Yeah,
like there was some violence. It was a bad scene, man.
Yeah. 94 is the one that I went to.
And one,
I would say David Copperfield supposedly making the Statue of Liberty disappear. That was so stupid. Broke ass. Like, you're watching on television. You're like,
Geraldo Rivera. Geraldo Rivera. Like, Al Capone's vault.
Yes. Oh, Al Capone's vault too. Yeah, that was really bad.
Yeah.
But David Copperfield making the Statue of Liberty disappear, it was like so clear. And I was just a dumb kid that was all about like, I think he's really going to do it.
Right.
And you could watch on television and be like, okay, it looks like maybe for this small sliver of people who are standing behind this, like, and where this it was just so obviously a television trick or something, and I'm still disgusted by it. And why I will never go see David Copperfield perform.
Good
ever.
Protest, Seth. I'm with you. I'm going to stand with you on that one.
Mine, I know, kind of, I won't say shocked, but set you back a little bit when I mentioned to you off the air.
Yeah.
And I don't mean this as if it was a bad thing. I had fun.
Okay.
But my own wedding. I mean, because of the stress and everybody's coming at you and you have to go, you know, do all these things and all. I enjoyed my three kids' weddings 100 times more than my own wedding.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're doing is scratching the check for those bad boys.
I think sometimes a wedding can be like.
No, there's a lot.
Yeah,
There's a lot. Have you shared this with Jan that your wedding was this stressful?
I just did.
No, we had a wedding coordinator who called in sick the day of the wedding.
What? Oh, dude.
So
now
that
was
stress. Fun. Yeah.
Do you know we don't have any photography pictures from our wedding?
Are you serious?
How? Our guy took the money and ran.
Oh, wow. No way.
We don't have a single one.
You hired
all
some
our pictures are
to...
on those old, you know, throwaway Kodak.
No way.
All the pictures of our wedding.
Well, and look how long your marriage has lasted.
Yeah.
You know?
So there's no real evidence is what I'm saying.
Look at you. Other than the stress you endured on the day. I had a blast at both of my weddings.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably why I wound up with a second wedding. I had such a good time at my first one.
The doubt started creeping in right then. She was like, oh, goodness.
I don't want to go too far. But yeah, like there was, like I was... you know, part of it was I got married pretty young. I got married, I think I was 25 when I got married.
Mm-hmm.
And my ex-wife was like 22. So we were pretty young by standards of the time. And I know at one point when things weren't going well in the conversations during our marriage, several years later, one of the things that got brought up, possibly in front of a therapist, was at our wedding, he wanted to go hang out with his friends.
No kidding.
More than hang out with me. And I'm like, yeah, that was kind of a jerk move. I did make sure. Amy got the benefit of that because I made sure to pay close attention to Amy the entire time at my second wedding.
What a champ.
Yeah. Hey, man, I learned from my behavior.
That's called growth. That is growth.
Everybody deserves a second chance. Yeah. I'm the Damon Arnett of husbands, all right?
Another one is first world problems, I know, and I don't mean to do this.
What are you doing right now?
The Super Bowl. The Super Bowl, if you go to a Super Bowl, it's awesome. After that,
once. Or if your team goes, which I've never been able to experience before. Yeah.
After that, it's just a hassle. It's a huge, huge hassle.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Security and everything. It's crazy. That's one you're going to get a lot of heat for.
I know.
You admitted first world problems. Yeah, you're good. You gave the caveat. All right, boys. Well, we will clear the deck for In the Loop here. Seth, antibodies to you, my friend.
Oh, antibodies and just fawning all over Amy for the rest of the week, too.
Thank you. I will. Yes. Done and done.
Hit go on the washing machine today if you can figure out how to do it.
Thanks for highlighting the issues with my second marriage.
Maybe keep her from herniating a disc.
That's right.
Take over some of the household chores.
She does complain about her back sometimes, so maybe that's true. Maybe I should learn how to push the buttons on the washer.
I have a feeling that that's not the part that's getting the back to be
full
issue,
disclosure, I have no idea how to work any of our appliances.
That's right.
Good Lord.
Yeah. It's all right, man. God. I make up for it in other ways.
I hope so.
Probably not enough. All right, we're done. We're out of time. I'm getting divorced, probably. You're listening to KLT AM, KLT FM HD2, Houston, and Odyssey Sports Station.